Welcome to the Trinity's Podcast, where we explore theories about the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Episode 27, interview with Dr. William Hasker about his Metaphysics and the Tripersonal God, Part 1. Dr. William Hasker is a leading Christian philosopher and analytic theologian. He is Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Huntington University in Huntington, Indiana, where he taught from 1966 to 2000. In addition to numerous articles, book chapters, and edited books, Dr. Hasker is the author of Metaphysics, 1983, God, Time, and Knowledge, 1989, The Emergent Self, 1999, Providence, Evil, and the Openness of God, 2004, and The Triumph of God Over Evil, 2008. From 2000 to 2007, he was the editor of Faith and Philosophy, the official journal of the Society of Christian Philosophers. He's with us today to discuss his latest book, Metaphysics and the Tripersonal God, published by Oxford University Press in 2013 as a part of their Oxford Studies in Analytic Theology series. Dr. Hasker, welcome to the Trinity's Podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Bill, before we get into the book, can you just tell us a little bit about your Christian background and how you first got interested in serious thinking about the Trinity?
I was brought up in a Christian home and went through various ups and downs, but sometime during my high school period, I really became very strongly committed to the Christian faith, and I attended Wheaton College, which was and is one of the outstanding Christian liberal arts colleges, and I was naturally drawn to philosophy and theology. I majored in biblical studies there. I attended Fuller Theological Seminary for 2 years, finished a Bachelor of Divinity, which was in the normal degree, at Berkeley Baptist Divinity School. After that, I went to the University of Edinburgh, to New College, the theological college there, and wrote a dissertation on the social analogy in modern Trinitarian thought under Professor John McIntyre, to whom this book is actually dedicated. It's just been natural for me to be interested in Christian philosophy and Christian theology. It's just a natural thing. Eventually, I began teaching philosophy I taught 1 year at another institution, but I taught at Huntington University for essentially all my professional life, and had many opportunities through contacts with other Christian philosophers to develop my thinking. And while the Trinity sort of lay fallow, in a sense, for a good many years, I eventually came back to it in the light of all the discussions that have been carried on in the intervening time. As you know, it's been a very active period for Trinitarian studies, both in theology and, although this is perhaps less widely known, in philosophy. And so there is a lot of material to work through and think about, and that's what this book is about.
Is it fair to say that off and on you've been thinking about the Trinity since the 1960s?
It's certainly been there, at least in the back of my thinking. I mean, I've never got away from it in one sense, but I haven't written about it actively since 1970, prior to this book. Well, and a few recent articles, as you know, but prior to very recent years.
Each year there are dozens of books published on the Trinity. Of the making of books, there is no end.
Absolutely.
In my view, though, this one really stands out in a lot of ways. I think that this is, to date, the best developed attempt at a social Trinity theory, what I call a three-self Trinity theory. And I think it's exceedingly well-written. A lot of people, I think, might be intimidated by picking up a book by a philosopher, but I think that the writing here is clear. I think there's not really a wasted paragraph in the book. I didn't ever get to a point where I thought, oh, okay, he's just repeating himself, or this is filler material or anything like that. It's a very tightly woven, big extended argument, but it occurs in a bunch of short chapters that are very, I think, well conceived. So I think it's a book that nobody should be afraid to tackle, whether they have some knowledge of philosophy or not. I think any theologian would be interested in it. I think even an interested layperson who's willing to do a little bit of hard thinking can work their way through the book and really get a lot out of it. Another thing I think a lot of people will want to see that we won't have very much time to get into right now is how you interact with a whole bunch of other people. So theologians like Karl Barth, Karl Rahner, Jürgen Moltmann, and philosophers including Brian Leftow, Peter Van Inwagen, Michael Ray, William Lane Craig, and Richard Swinburne. You interact with each one of these in original ways and try to, in each case, get something positive out of their treatment of the Trinity. Dr. Hasker, is there any one particular person who's most influenced you in your thinking about the Trinity?
That's an interesting question. I probably couldn't single out any one person. Of course, when I wrote my dissertation, Leonard Hodgson was one of the important pioneers of modern social Trinitarian thought, and certainly that had a considerable influence then, but as you know, I actually deviate from his views in some respects. I don't think there's any one individual that sort of stands out as being that dominant. The one chunk from my dissertation that gets more or less transplanted here was some of the material on Karl Barth, who of course is massively influential in this as in many other areas of theology. But again, I don't agree with Barth all that much, so I can't list him as a dominant influence, really.
Yeah, no, that sounds right to me, having read your book and your other articles that you've written about the Trinity. You're not really following any one person. You're sort of trying to fairly gain what you can from any of them. So let's get a little bit into the substance of the Trinity. The famous Nicene Creed says that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are three persons in one substance. You accept that creed, I take it, and can you just explain how you understand the claim of the Nicene Creed, that they're one substance or one essence?
All right, first of all, that they are three persons. They are three personal subjects, personal agents, individuals who cognate, who respond effectively, who have volition, who act. There are three of those, and of course that's, to me, that's the core idea of social Trinitarianism. But then that they are one substance. This comes down to the idea of what is the divine nature. In modern philosophy, I think it's typical to understand nature in an abstract sense as a collection of attributes. The nature of gold is to be the 79, element 79 in the atomic table, and it has various attributes, various properties that go along with that. And if you add up all those properties, that's the nature of gold, which can be, of course, can be shared by any number of individual gold objects. But there's also a sense, and I think this is the one that's more central in the Trinitarian tradition, but it certainly has plausibility outside of that, in which a nature is a concrete. A nature is the instantiation of a property for an individual. So to say that a person has a generous nature is saying something about that person. Generosity is incorporated into what that person is. And so I think that when we speak about the persons of the Trinity as having one nature, this is a nature in the concrete sense. There is, to use a term of modern philosophy, contemporary philosophy, there's one trope of Godhood among the three persons. And so there is literally one Godhood, one divine nature, one concrete divine nature, which is held in common, which is shared between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Now that's, I admit, a difficult concept, and some people find it incoherent. I don't think it is incoherent, but arguing that that is coherent and how to understand it is certainly one of the major ideas that is developed in the book.
Now, some people would say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So in your view, why can't we just stick with the ancient creedal language and kind of leave things at that?
Well, we can, and many people do, and I don't necessarily criticize them for it. On the other hand, some of us feel a need to understand what we're saying when we affirm the ancient creedal language. In fact, I think it's pretty obvious that the meaning, as one probes it, is not self-evident. You have to go back to the ancient theologians, especially the ones that have come to be called the pro-Nicene theologians of the 4th century, and see what they meant by the terms that they were using. And when you do that, then it isn't so simple. It's not that the creed is broke. I certainly don't think that. But if you want to understand it, you have to take it apart a little bit. And of course, as you well know, there are many challenges in the modern era that it is broke, that the creed is incoherent, or anyhow, it's something that contemporary Christians have no need to concern themselves with, that it's really irrelevant to the Christian life. And if one is going to respond to those sorts of challenges, simply repeating a formula doesn't really work. It doesn't address that.
Right. So one thing you're doing is focusing on the key term in the creeds, which is ousia, or substance, essence, nature, and trying to see how that is to be rightly understood, especially taking into consideration what was meant back in the 4th century when they formulated that. Some people would object that we're running the risk of failing to preserve the mystery, and that if we try to understand these things, we're going to end up cramming the transcendent God into our little mental categories. How do you respond to concerns like that?
Well, I mean, this is not altogether, let's say, it's not an off-the-wall response. I mean, there is, on the one hand, there's a danger of over-rationalizing and oversimplifying and, as you put it, cramming God into our categories. But I think there's a danger on the other side of simply repeating formulas that we don't understand, or of leaving God as so mysterious that we can't really say anything about him that makes any sense. So I think certainly we should keep our sense of reverence and mystery and awe before God. But at the same time, we should use our best intelligence, our best intellectual tools to try to understand what's going on here. And certainly this is what the fathers of the church did. I mean, they were deeply conscious of mystery. They have a lot to say about that. But they also used the very best intellectual tools available to them to try to understand as best we can what we need to say about God. And I think that if we are going to follow in their footsteps, we can't do it by simply repeating their words. We have to try to understand what the words mean. So it just seems an inevitable challenge that we have to... Peter Van Inwagen made an interesting comment in this context. He said, okay, yes, it's a mystery, and if there are even contradictions here that we don't see how to reconcile, well, maybe that's what we should expect for the mystery of God. But he goes on to say, as a philosopher, I would find it disappointing if there were nothing that could be said beyond that. I mean, it's the nature of philosophy to try to understand, and that's what I'm trying to do.
So another key term in the creeds that you want to understand is the term person, and you've already said a little bit about this, but one thing that I often hear from contemporary theologians is something like this. They say that the, quote, persons of the Trinity are not persons in the modern sense of the word, but they're more something like masks that God wears or roles that God eternally plays. Do you agree with that?
No, I certainly don't agree with that. Now, obviously, the concept of person and our our contemporary interest in psychology and so on has delved into this. And there are some connotations of the concept of person as we use it, perhaps, that we don't want to apply to the Trinity. As I remarked somewhere in the book, that we would not welcome the persons of the Trinity being portrayed as existentialist heroes, you know, the existentialist who cuts himself off from everybody else and follows his own inner commitment wherever it goes and, you know, whoever it harms and so on. That's not what we're talking about. But the concept of a personal agent, an individual who understands and makes decisions and performs actions, that's very basic in human thinking. You couldn't deal intelligently with any human thought form, I think, without that idea of a personal agent. It's very deep-rooted. And it seems to me that that's the concept that is needed when we're talking about the persons of the Trinity. And of course, as you well know, the crucial issue here is the relation between Jesus Christ and the Father in heaven. What the church has come to hold, and I know you don't fully agree with this, right? But what the church has come to hold is that Christ is divine, he is fully God, and he is also human. But in the New Testament, we see Jesus, the Christ, interacting with God the Father in a way that we would have to describe as person to person, one person to another. And it seems to me that if one speaks of the persons of the Trinity as like masks or roles, you really can't make good sense of that relationship between Jesus and the Father. That is really the core from which the doctrine of the Trinity emerges. Later on, of course, well, the Holy Spirit is also featured in the New Testament, but not as prominently in that sense, although the Spirit is accorded personal attributes, but it's the relationship between Jesus and the Father that is absolutely crucial. And I think something like a social Trinitarianism is required if we're going to make good sense of that. And just as a passing thought, in talking about Barth, now Barth repudiates social Trinitarianism. He says pretty emphatically that the persons of the Trinity are not persons in the modern sense. And yet, when he's talking about Jesus and the Father, he lapses into the very kind of person talk that he has officially repudiated, which tells me that it's harder to get away from that than a lot of people think.
In part one of your book, Bill, you argue that important ancient theologians such as Augustine and Gregory of Nyssa are best understood as what you call pro-social. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, what I'm getting at there is I don't want to call them straight out social Trinitarians, because that would call to mind recent social Trinitarians such as Leonard Hodgson, Moltmann, Zizioulas, and others who developed the ideas in the light of modern psychology and sociology in ways that certainly are not found in the ancient writers. So I think it's useful to recognize that there is a difference between these recent and contemporary social Trinitarians and ancient fathers. In calling them pro-social, I am asserting that they did, in fact, view the persons of the Trinity as persons in something that's at least strongly analogous to our ordinary concept of person. And so it's, if you draw the line, as I do, between pro-social and anti-social Trinitarians, they are properly seen as pro-social, as favoring a social kind of interpretation, even though they certainly don't have all the developments of modern thought in mind as they're working out their ideas.
So to kind of sum up your view about the persons then, would it be fair to put it like this? Persons of the Trinity really are three individuals. They're three thinkers. Each can act on his own. Each is a hymn, is a personal being, and yet they're not individualistic or individualists, not existential heroes. They're united in a number of ways, which I think you discuss later in the book and which we'll get into in the next segment. So they're closely united in several ways, but they really are three beings. Is that right?
Yeah, the sense in which they are three beings needs to be carefully specified. And as you noted there, a lot more needs to be said about their unity. But I think you're certainly on the right track in what you're saying there, yes.
So then the Trinity is going to be, in some sense, the whole or the sum of these. And this, for some people, will immediately bring to mind the traditional doctrine of divine simplicity. And I think a lot of Christian lay people really have never heard of divine simplicity, but some theologians, and particularly people who specialize in the history of theology and ancient history of theology, often consider divine simplicity to be a core commitment of classical Christian thinking about God. Could you just explain for us what the doctrine of divine simplicity is and what your stance toward that doctrine is?
In 30 words or less, right?
Okay. Three hours or less.
there is a limited sense in which I think all theists will affirm divine simplicity, which is to say that God is not a symbol out of parts and cannot be decomposed into parts. And of course, that very much distinguishes God from any material thing. All physical things are assembled, are made of parts, made of pieces, and can be, at least in principle, disintegrated into those pieces, except maybe for elementary particles, but let's not get into that. Okay, but the doctrine of divine simplicity as it has been developed, essentially it says that there are no distinctions within God. Any distinctions that exist within God are purely a matter of our concepts, our ways of thinking about God, but don't apply to God in God's self. This is, in the first place, very difficult to understand, and also, I think, difficult to reconcile with various Christian doctrines, including the doctrine of the Trinity. And, for instance, Thomas Aquinas says that the distinctions of the persons are distinctions of reason, but not real distinctions. Well, what that seems to amount to is that the difference between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is a difference in the way we think about God, but not a real difference in God himself. But that's inconsistent with a lot of the things that Thomas himself says. So if you accept this very strong doctrine of simplicity, you end up tying yourself in knots in a whole number of ways. That's only one of them. And so with a great many contemporary Christian philosophers and theologians, I think that strong doctrine of simplicity simply is one that we cannot and need not and should not accept. It represents the wish to make God absolute, to make God transcendent, to make God different from everything that God has created. And I respect those inclinations, but I think they have to be satisfied in some other way than with this strong doctrine of simplicity.
This is one reason why I said that your book is a bold one, because you are trying to be as traditional as possible, but you're reasoning very carefully. And when you consider all the factors together, your view is that, well, if we can't keep all the balls in the air at the same time, maybe something's going to have to change about the mainstream tradition. And you do sort of make a hard call and a bold move here about divine simplicity. You don't say, well, we have to have that, and it doesn't really seem to fit with these other things, but what are you going to do? It's a mystery. You say, well, I think it needs to be understood in a less extreme way, and here's how I understand it.
It isn't. I mean, this is not such a radical thing to do in the context of contemporary Christian philosophy and theology. But you're right, it is a marked deviation from one strand in the tradition, and some people will find that objectionable. So we have to fight it out. You know, that's the way these things go.
Our next episode will feature the rest of the interview with Dr. William Hasker, in which we discuss the particulars of his Trinity theory, and also some objections as to whether or not it is truly monotheistic. See you then.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you online at trinities.org.